Star jump sequence terminates, Captain.
Get the gravitational dampers online and open the blast shield.
Aye, sir.
Bring us in closer.
Aye, aye, sir. Moving us in on sublight drive.
Extreme magnification.
Aye, sir.
The center of the galaxy. And there's our black hole.
The experience of a lifetime, Captain.
Let me put this on audio. You should be able to hear the magnetic resonance.
This is it, ladies and gentlemen. The edge of time and space, where the impossible can happen. Welcome to the event horizon.
Hey. You see that article about how everybody's now claiming that their movies don't use anything but practical effects?
Yeah, that's...
They're dreaming.
No,
that's... I thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, that's not true.
And I know that the director of Napoleon, Ridley Scott, in his interview, he was saying, oh, only the cannonball, you know, everything else was that.
We want
to include this in the talk.
So let me do the roll in and then we'll get going. Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week at this time. I stumbled over that. Join us each week at this time as we discuss the.
Do you want to start over?
I need to start over, because I do this by rote, and I don't have the notes in front of me. Good morning, or afternoon, or evening, whatever is relevant for the part of the world you are in. Indeed, welcome to the Event Horizon, where the impossible happens. Join us each week as we delve into the worlds of science fiction, fantasy, and science fact in all their forms. I am your host, Gene Turnbow.
And I am your other host, Susan Fox.
And with us is a rather remarkable man by the name of Bill Kimberlin, who has written a memoir called Inside the Star Wars Empire. Welcome to the show, Bill. We're glad to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. I'm speaking to you from Northern California. And ILM is... now in San Francisco, but it used to be in Marin County, which is just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. And I grew up in Marin County, and I had my first experiences with something to do with movies in Marin County. My mother took me to the set of a film called Blood Alley, which starred John Wayne and I think it was Bogart's wife.
Lauren Bacall.
In real life. Yeah, Lauren Bacall. Yeah. So anyway, I'm about 7 years old, and I'm walking into the set, which was a local Chinese shrimping community right on the bay. They fish for shrimp and dried it and sold it in San Francisco and locally. And as I was walking in, there was a giant stack of boulders. And I happened to brush up against them, and one of them moved. And I thought, well, how could they move? I just barely, oh, they're fake. And that's how I was introduced to the idea that adults who worked in motion pictures got to do stuff like this. They got to fake stuff. And I wound up faking stuff over about 3 miles from there, where Industrial Light and Magic was then located, and where I started in 1982, after working about 12 years making my own films, directing a feature film which is still in release called American Nitro. It's about drag racing, the same thing that George Lucas got interested in for his first really successful movie, American Graffiti. And most people don't know this, but Industrial Light and Magic, both when it was in Los Angeles and when it moved up to Marin County, is in an area where if you looked at a zoning map, it would say light industrial. That's what it's known for.
Oh,
that's
interesting.
That comes from.
Yeah, I remember.
And so,
I remember.
George just added the word magic.
Oh,
and
that's
he had
funny.
Industrial Light Magic. Now we asked him once about it, and he said, "I can't remember" or something. But I remember. I mean, it wasn't that hard to put those two together.
Yeah, I remember around 19, I guess around 79, 1980, something, and driving by this little brick building in Universal City called the Egg Company.
My dad had an office there, right. You know.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah, so.
Well, yeah, that was one of George's. He's great with names. You know, that's how he came up with R2-D2, right? You've heard, you know that story, right?
Real one,
yeah.
Dialogue 2, a real 2, Dialogue 2. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so I think it was Ben Burt was mixing American Graffiti. No, it was someone else, a famous sound mixer guy, Walter Murch, and he was mixing American Graffiti, and he called to the projection booth, put up R2-D2. And, you know, in the lingo of the mixing world, that means picture roll 2, dialogue roll 2.
Fantastic.
And so the area in Los Angeles was also in the light industrial district. And we couldn't be at Skywalker Ranch because we were too dirty. We blew stuff up. If you wanted to blow up a Star Destroyer, light industrial areas are where you do it.
That's funny.
That's so funny. Yeah. So George did not like Marin. I mean, he moved to Marin because he did not like Los Angeles.
Uh-huh.
And my friends who worked with him for years said, you know, he starts to get nervous and wants to go home when he's down there for something. And I remember we were sitting in the screening room and somebody talked about, well, they were going to go down, they were going to talk to Disney about this, that, or the other thing. And then the head of ILM at the time, Tom Smith, said, well, it'll be around 4 o'clock, you know, the traffic. He said, we're taking the Disney copter, so don't worry about it.
Oh, boy.
So, you know, you have other choices when you're at his level of fame and fortune, I guess.
That's pretty amazing. Yeah. So you worked for them since...
Since Return of the Jedi.
Right. So I started... They wanted to hire an editor, a visual effects editor, which is a job of lacing together all of the elements that they have shot over the last, month, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
So the spaceships against blue screen, the Death Star... The explosions, all of the, we would get a storyboard and it would have on it a list of everything that was to be in that shot.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would just rummage through past 2 films to find an explosion or a cloud or something else to make the scene work. And so they wanted somebody. In visual effects, you get folks that are very, very focused on the one thing that they do, the expertise. And these people are real artists, were fun to work with. You'd get, you know, they'd leave me notes when they wanted to either chastise me or praise me or apologize uh-huh. for forgetting something. And I'd get this drawing, you know, this fancy drawing. Of him, you know, drunk out of his mind, supposedly, and beer bottles all over, you know, and uh-huh. girls climbing out windows and saying, "I'm sorry, Bill, you know, but I was looking for it in your department, but I had it after all. Sorry, you know." And I'd get things from Ken Rawson, who was my supervisor. He would draw a cartoon clock, and it would say, "Hurry up, Bill." You know, these were all things to break the tension because. we're making a movie that is highly anticipated, and you don't want to disappoint every child in the world.
Oh,
not just America, the world. I was in the business office one day, and I saw this list of where one of the Star Wars was playing or had played. And let's say it was Empire. So it would be countries. Well, every country. And then it would be by city. Well, you know how many cities there are in the world? There are a lot of cities. And then the theaters. Every city has a lot of theaters, the big cities. And so you got the scope of the thing right there by seeing it on paper where this was going to be shown. And that was everywhere. And who was going to see it? Everybody. So that was on your mind. And we would joke. Ken used to get letters. Ken Ralston, my boss, one of the major supervisors, along with Dennis Muren and, you know, others. He would get letters from a kid in Japan, you know, and who had slowed down a videotape and found errors, and he's writing Ken about these problems. So Ken would say, okay, let's do it one more time for that kid in Japan, because I don't want to get another letter from him.
That's great. And this is all...
So we were aware they were out there. I mean, it was no question. They would show up. We had to work under false names. Like for Jedi, if someone asked, we said we're working on a film called Blue Harvest. And so we all had T-shirts and caps and everything that said Blue Harvest. And then we would have the kids going through the garbage, and we'd have people showing up from, you know, we had driven from, you know, what was one place? Broken Axle, Oklahoma.
Because of course, everybody knew it was Blue Harvest.
Can't you just see that that's where the wagon broke down, and they decided they weren't going any farther? The town was going to be here. Broken Axle, Oklahoma.
Oh, yeah.
And this lady came in the front door one day. You know, we were hiding it. It didn't say anything about the movies. It said a Kerner Optical Research or something. And this lady said to the receptionist and a bunch of jokers that were sitting around in the front office, what do you actually do here? She said. And we had this guy named Mike Fulmer, and he was an ex Green Beret, and he was a model maker, and he was a screenwriter and all this stuff. And he said, we manufacture and test rectal thermometers. So
yeah, that's optical.
So she stopped asking questions, and we had a laugh out of it. And Mike
That's
built
awesome.
The tri-motor in Indiana Jones, you know, the one that hits the top of the mountain, which was, we shot that in the parking lot between C and D buildings. And he built this incredible scale airplane. And, you know, everything we did would be a mixture of sizes. You know, there was a full Millennium Falcon in England on the stage, and then we would have some that were, you know, the size of a chew box, and then some real tiny ones. It's all about scale when you're doing visual effects. You have to maintain the idea that this is really huge, or it's really small, or you're cutting between two things. One is the door to Jabba's palace, which you have your characters standing in front of it, and then you cut to a map painting where you're able to make the door open and the characters go in and out. Whatever the gimmick is you're doing. Some of this goes back as far as the days, you know, before Charlie Chaplin, with, you know, a painting on glass and leaving a space where you could then optically insert some live action.
Georges Méliès.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So there's a great book by Craig Barron about the art of matte painting, and it really shows you some of the incredible history. I worked on Saving Private Ryan, and I took an example down to Indiana University in Bloomington, and I gave a talk, and I showed a clip of the D-Day beach that was as Steven Spielberg sent it to us. It was a crane shot that reveals the beach, and there was nothing on the beach. Well, then I had it set up so that I dissolved through to the elements that we added one at a time, the soldiers marching up and down, the tanks, the matte painting of the ships, etc. And after I showed this, these history professors walked up to me and they said, "Don't you realize how dangerous this is?" They thought we just did dinosaurs and spaceships. They didn't realize that we could recreate history. They were thinking we were Lenny Riefenstahl or something, and this was dangerous. Now, I can't imagine what they think about things now.
See their point, because some, you know, gang of visual effects from the other side could recreate this and make it look like the other side won if they had a political need to do so.
Exactly. And we've got a presidential candidate doing that right now.
Unfortunately, yes.
I always thought we could make the greatest UFO film, you know, of a spaceship or something, and we would leave it in a camera or a camera box at a, you know, a flea market, and let somebody find it and see what would happen. Because people used to bring us books with so-called pictures of the flying saucers, and you know, the guys in the optical department would just tear these things apart.
I mean, that's grandma's pie pan. We can do better than this.
A pie pan on a string, that sort of stuff, and you can see the string clearly in the photo. Yeah, I've seen some of those. Yeah, I've had some practical effects experience and some digital effects experience, and it is amazing how much you can do with visual effects. And you were saying, I think before the show, that some of the directors now are saying, "Oh, we only use practical effects." Well,
right.
Yeah,
it's funny how that has developed, where it's now you get a greater props, I guess. If you say, you know, you didn't use effects, so, you know, we had a little here and there, but you didn't really use it, which is kind of, I don't know what to make of that. I do know that George got all the major directors together and to show them, you know, he was trying to get people to, Hollywood and directors to accept digital filmmaking, digital editing, digital projection, all visual effects, everything. And the directors didn't want it. Quentin Tarantino still is shoots on film, projects on film, has a movie theater in Los Angeles called the Beverly Cinema, and he invited me to show my film there, American Nitro. And he doesn't show anything but film. And
that's very rare now.
Has famously said, "Digital, I didn't sign up for this. As long as I'm rich," he said, "I'm going to keep doing this the way I want to do it."
Well, he's rich; he can do it, and it doesn't hurt anybody. Right. And good for him.
Yeah, well, yeah. And it's kind of cool to see something projected.
You know,
the story that I heard about Napoleon is when they got the damn thing finished and they projected it, it was so sharp it looked like a television basketball game. You know, that too sharp look of video.
Oh yes,
and television.
It's so sharp it hurts to watch.
They took and they filmed the digital master out to a film negative, and then they scanned that back in, and that's what they went with, because it gave it the so-called film look. And we used to joke that over in CG there was a button that said film look, and you could press it.
And there was. I mean, actually was. I was working at Rhythm and Hue Studios for about 10 years during the during the time when the industry was transitioning from doing everything on film to doing everything digitally. And so the effects that we would do would wind up on, I think, 4K plates or something, or 2K plates. That's all we needed, really. And then it would go through the film scanner, and we would deliver film elements if the client wanted that. Or we would deliver the elements on hard disks if the client wanted that. And the mix was about 50-50 when I started in 2003, and it was almost 100% digital by the time I left in 2013.
Right. So we struggled with that, especially with Schindler's List. Spielberg wanted it to look a certain way, like the old black and white movies looked. And so we made some tests for him so that he could shoot it on color stock, and then we would drain all the color out of it. And he was just not happy. No, that's not what I want. Okay, so I was thinking to myself, so how are you going to do the scene with the girl and the little girl in the red dress? How are you going to do that when you release your movie in black and white? Tell me about how that. Now, you could do it today, but at that time, you could not do that. There wasn't any way. I mean, if you're going to print a color scene on black and white, guess what? It's going to be black and white.
Yeah.
So I thought, well, you know, the only way I could see we could do this, but this is so crazy the studio will never go for it, is every one of those scenes in 5,000 prints would have to be cut in to the release print. And then you've got splices, et cetera. But that's exactly what they did.
I'll be.
And if there had been anybody but Steven Spielberg, no one, they would, like, we don't like black and white movies because they don't rent well in video stores or DVD. And so forget it, Mr. Director. But he wasn't just anybody. And so he got what he wanted.
Well, in I think it was
Hand-tinted prints.
The hand-tinted prints. Oh. Yeah, it was. I did film restoration for a while, and one of the prints we did was something called "In the Garden," and it was from the turn of the previous century. And there was the big deal with this film was that the scenes where the lovers met in the garden were. They were green. They were green tinted. And that was something no one had ever seen before. And it turns out that we had to print it all black and white because the only way that they could get the color in that scene was to hand tint every single release print.
There were fewer theaters then than there are now.
Yeah. But that's how they released it.
Yep.
Well, there's a great story about a Russian photographer who invented a system where he would take three black and white images and then map them together and project them, and he had color photographs. Mm-hmm. And he displayed this for the Tsar. Now, this was about the time you're talking about, 1908 to maybe 1912. And the Tsar said, okay, I'm giving you a train, a locomotive and a bunch of cars, and I want you to go all over Russia and document it, which he did.
And
so the Library of Congress wound up with these. These are glass plates.
Yeah, yeah.
But they couldn't figure out, there wasn't any way to line them up. But there was a guy who invented a computer program, and they were able to line them up and print them. And you can go on the site of the Library of Congress, and you can see inside Russia people and all kinds of interesting features and buildings and railroads
in full color.
It just brightens it up. It just brings it to life.
I have seen a bunch of those photos over the years. Had not known the backstory of how those came to be. When I was at UCLA, I had a class in the history of color in cinematography, and that particular excursion was not discussed. But other methods were, and color, the first color being Technicolor, and working kind of similarly to it, where they would print each color by running it through a different vat of colored ink and having a camera that ran three strips of film, each with a different filter in front of the lens, so that they had three different camera negatives, and then combine them all after the fact to produce the release prints.
And
it was
a wild, wacky
printing process.
That was invented by a guy named Douglas, and he lived in San Rafael. And when I was on my lunch hour from ILM one day, I went by the Historical Society, and they had a whole thing on him. So I looked into it, and he and his partner had developed the Victrola. And the thing about the Victrola was that women would not allow a device like this in their living room unless it had a beautiful wooden case.
Uh-huh.
So this was so popular, this device, they hired 7,000 carpenters to build the cases for the Victrola.
That's...
Okay.
Wow.
Okay. I'm reading about this guy, and he's an inventor. He became ill. The doc said, you need to move to California. It's a warmer climate. He sold out his interest. He built a mansion in San Rafael, which is now it's a Kiwanis Club or something. But but his gatehouse was, they gave it to the city, and it's where the Historical Society is. And the gatehouse is as big as a normal small mansion. So anyway, he was an inventor. He had all kinds of things that he built for cameras, and he leased them to Hollywood so they could do special effects. And he had an underwater camera, and he had all this stuff. But he came up with this Technicolor system, and he took it to Hollywood. He shot a film with Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford, because they were friends of his, got it in color, released it. He took it down to Hollywood, and no one was interested. They wouldn't buy it, even though he had history with them. So a few years, 2 years maybe later, Technicolor and Disney and all these companies are releasing movies in Technicolor, and he sued them, and he won.
Wow.
And he got about $25 million in 1938 or something.
Oh,
like
God,
that
was just...
Stars.
Yeah.
You could buy a country for that.
The studios did not show up for the trial, so he won it on... And then they settled. He actually sued for more than that, but they settled. I'm hazy on this, but it was around $20 million. Just an incredible... So he... built a mansion. He bought a mansion down in Los Altos, below San Francisco, and he had a swimming pool with a window so he could film divers and stuff. He was quite a character. And
Wow.
That's a girls' school now. I went down and researched it.
And the
mansion is a girls' school. It's huge.
Oh my gosh!
He had all of his inventions there, and he had a workshop and everything. So anyway, that's the story of Technicolor, where it actually came from.
You know, I think I had one of those cabinets. When I was going to UCLA Film School, when I was living in Sylmar, my wife at the time liked to collect antiques, and she had one of those wooden cabinet Victrolas.
Yeah.
It didn't work, but we had it in the living room, and it was a conversation piece.
Well, and that just opened up a whole, you know, trend in interior decorating. So you had the beautiful cabinets for radios and later, you know, major pieces of furniture for televisions. So that really
Was a long lasting thing. Because, you know, he realized, or they realized, the two partners, that to get this into the lady's house, who really, you know, that's her domain, and she's not letting some metal contraption in there because the husband wants to listen to, you know, the records. Or at that time, they were, let's see.
Cylinders?
Were they discs?
Yeah, they were, yeah.
Wax cylinders.
Edison had the cartridges.
Yeah, Edison had the wax cartridges.
So I think these guys had taken the basic idea and created something that worked off of the disc.
Yeah, by that time it would have been.
I worked for the guy who developed the tape recorder. His name was Bill Palmer, and I worked for him for 12 years. And they knew that something had been invented in Germany, because they were trying to bomb the hell out of Hitler, and they thought they knew when he was speaking live because there was no background hiss.
But that's funny.
They never got it. And so they knew something had happened. They didn't know what it was. And so Bill's partner, he was assigned by the military to go in and find whatever this thing is. And he found it in a radio station. He took it apart and he mailed it to Bill's mother's house. And then when he came back from the war, they took it to Ampex, mm-hmm. and they developed it. And Bing Crosby put up $250,000 because he hated the idea of having to do two shows a day, one for the East Coast, one for the West Coast.
Right.
And the studio would not allow a recording because they weren't very good. And so along the way, they invented the term bias, which is putting an electrical charge to the tape at mm-hmm. the same mm-hmm. time you're recording. And it lowers the background sound dramatically. And so Bill told me, we never thought we'd sell more than five. Or, you know, NBC, ABC, CBS. It never occurred to us that this would be in every house in America someday.
Oh yeah.
So, because the thing was as big as a refrigerator.
Oh yeah, they were massive because, you know, Jurassic technology is always big, and the first iteration of something is always huge.
Yeah, right. Interesting. Yeah, I'm a big fan of the Wright brothers, and there's a wonderful book on them, and you know, they were high school graduates. That's it, and they solved a problem that men had been thinking about for a couple of thousand years.
Oh,
and they
at
were
least.
The first ones to do it. And there's never been a movie about them that I know of. Maybe you know of one. It's such an incredible story that these two guys just do it all themselves. They never took any money. They used the funds from their bicycle shop to fund this.
Which is amazing that you could get that much technology out of a bicycle shop.
Well, it makes sense, though.
They were so inventive. You know, they invented a way to test wings. You know, like now you would put them in a wind tunnel. Well, they put the wing styles on the front of the bicycle and pedaled as fast as they could to check out, you know, how it worked. And they watched birds for hours to figure out, well, how are they doing this? And they realized, finally, that the bird has to learn how to fly. And if we're going to fly, we have to learn. It's a technique. It's a way of moving the wings. And so they had all these elaborate cables moving the wings. Anyway, that's a side story. But I'm hoping
I think there have probably been television movies of the week or something done about them. But
we know someone who's
nothing noteworthy.
We know someone who's done a play about them. Maybe we should talk them into making a movie.
Oh, what's the play?
It's, you know how Boys in the Boat was such a big hit.
Uh huh.
I mean, the Wright brothers, who outfoxed everybody, you know. The guy that ran the Smithsonian Institution put $500,000 into trying to build a plane that would fly, stole every idea he could from the Wright brothers, and it just kept crashing. Hmm. And theirs, they were able to do controlled flight, and that's what the military wanted. They had to prove. So they wrote to the National Weather Service, and they said, where does the wind never stop blowing, and it's also soft because we plan on crashing a lot? And they said, you've got to go to Kitty Hawk. That's where it's a barrier island off the East Coast. The wind never stops, and you can, you know, fly your plane there. And, you know, it was just a glider at that point.
So I have a question about visual effects and opticals. At what point... Yeah. There was a particular compositing machine that Robert Blalock developed that let you run, I think, 4 optical elements at one time and print down to one. When did that?
Yeah, the quad printer.
Yeah, the quad printer. Quad printer. When did that?
And so that was a brainchild of Richard Edlund, who was the big honcho there, and developed, you know, he had been a cable car conductor, and he invented the pig nose. I don't know if you know what that is, but musicians all know.
Oh, yeah. I know what it is. Pig nose amplifier.
So, yeah, exactly. He invented that. And he was a really interesting guy. He didn't believe in banks and stuff, and so he collected antique shotguns. And I really liked him. He is the only guy there. When I first started, I'm back in the booth, and I'm projecting something for him and a bunch of other people. And he came back to the booth, stuck out his head, and said, "Hi, I'm Richard Edlund." And no one does that. I mean, that reminds me of a story of George Lucas. I talked to a guy who was being interviewed by George and Marcia to run his ranch, Skywalker Ranch, just after he started building the thing. And he told me, he said, I was in there, and they were, I asked him, I said, well, you know, George, can I bring my friends? Can I stay? He said, this will be your home. Okay, so three quarters of the way into the interview, there's a knock on George's door, and it's his private secretary, and she said, excuse me, George, I don't mean to interrupt, but I have Laurence Olivier on the phone, and he would like to talk to you. And George said, I'm talking to Bob right now. Tell him I'll get back to him. And that does not happen in Hollywood.
Nope.
No. Wow.
And that is George Lucas. If you want to know who George Lucas is, that's the kind of person he is, as far as I know. He was also extremely reticent around people he didn't know. I had a friend who worked for him for 2 years, and he said, I walked up to him in the hallway one day and stuck out my hand, and I said, hi, my name's Tim, I've worked with you for 2 years, and I've never met you. And he said the guy practically jumped backwards. It was just too much.
Wow.
Too much reality. Now, you know, it's a lot of years later now, and I don't know if he's like that at all.
You know, he may have gotten accustomed to dealing with people by this time, but you know, you never know.
Well,
some people are just very private.
He lived in Marin.
Uh-huh.
He lived in Marin because people would leave him alone. You know, they knew who he was. He'd go to the kids, parents at night at the schools. He would sign autographs for children, but almost no one else. And a bunch of his executives brought a bunch of things in one day to a big meeting and wanted him to sign them. And he said, listen, this is a business. I'm not signing, greeting cards. So, you know, he was a serious guy. But he also had a lot of smarts. And that's not easy. You know, his father ran a stationery store in the Desto. I went down to look at it because I wanted to find out who this guy was, where he came from. And his father, you know, he called his father when he was in college and he said, you know, how long do I have to do this? He didn't like it. And the old man ruled. But once he got into film school, it was like, wow,
yeah,
I know how to do this.
Yeah, he and his father did not see eye to eye on his future. His father wanted him to go into the stationery business.
Right. And but I think, well, I know that I saw the father. We had a big 4th of July picnic at the ranch every year, Skywalker Ranch. And I saw the father running around with the biggest smile on his face. You know, the kid had had done it. You know, he had done it. And he was so proud, you could tell. And,
oh, that's good.
So we saw something across the field. It was a bunch of scaffolding and timbers going up. And we said to George, what is that? And he said, that's going to be my office. Well, this is a 50,000 square foot building that looks like a hotel, the New Hampshire or something.
Mm-hmm.
Beautifully.
That's
beautifully
fantastic.
Good. I used to have lunch there all the time. I loved going there. They had a chef, and you got treated right.
So how many Star Wars films did you work on overall?
I worked on Jedi, and I dug through all the stuff that was from the two prior ones, looking for things. I actually found the original work print for Star Wars, because I had the archive in my department. And so I thought, well, take a look. And I put it up on a chem with the soundtrack. And it was the wackiest looking thing you ever saw in your life. There were, you know, all the guns were just like spitting little sparks that would like drop, and there was no effects, and there was no the sound. You could hear George saying, look to your left, look to your left. You know, this is just raw. And this is the kind of thing that you don't want the crew to ever see, because if they start thinking, what a turkey this is. You know, you got to be careful who sees your stuff. And a lot of directors wouldn't show us their films. Ron Howard would. Spielberg would send us sections. The first Jim Carrey movie that was a big hit.
The Mask?
The Mask. He showed us that. In fact, he gave me a videotape when I took it home, the director. And we all thought that the actress was just the director's girlfriend, because she'd never been in a movie, and he saw her in the front of a magazine. And Jim Carrey was, nobody knew who he was. He'd made two pictures, but they hadn't been released yet, and the studio was arguing about his salary for The Mask. But he was such a talent. We had a producer on The Mask that was kind of an idiot, and I think if you even questioned him closely, he would admit he was an idiot. And so Carrey starts doing this guy, and it was uncanny. It was uncanny. You know, I was like, how does he do that? Because, you know, I've seen him do some different characters, you know, just with a facial, and he'll turn around and shuffle his shoulders and then turn back and he's somebody else. But I saw it for real, and nobody knew who he was, but I could tell you, this guy is a talent. And this is going to explode.
Yeah.
Yeah, The Mask must have looked like a nothing burger without the special effects. I mean, imagine seeing the work print of that, except for Carrie's face. really brought everything through.
There's some stills in my book of him miming that he has the face on, you know, and then we added the face. And there was a whole sequence before the movie, as it now is, starts, about a bunch of pirates who had the mask, and it has ruined their lives, and so they take it to this island and they bury it in the chest and all this stuff. And at some point the director just said, stop working on that. I cut the whole thing off, and it starts with the bank scene, I think, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, then you'd have to explain how it got back there, and shoot the sheriff in the first reel, man.
It's like a lot of people who write screenplays eventually realize, you know, we have to start right in the middle of the action or, you know, some scene.
Yeah, because
we
what
have
they
to have a dramatic question in mm-hmm. the first scene. And if you don't have that, everything else up to that is just overwrite.
Yeah, because
and you have to kill yeah. your little darlings.
Yeah, because very frequently what they'll do is they'll write the backstory and they think they've written the first act.
No, no.
Yeah. No, yeah. You can't start there.
Exactly, yeah. Well, there was a... Spielberg had this writer who wrote Apocalypse Now and... God, what's his name? He was really responsible for some of the Clint Eastwood lines. And he came through editorial one day, and he was the most fascinating guy. Anyway, Spielberg had called him the greatest hood-of-a-car screenwriter I ever met. By the way, you need the scene's not working. You need some lines, and this guy would crank them out.
Yeah, and the screenplay was co-written by Coppola, John Milius, and Michael Hare.
John Milius, that's Milius.
John Milius.
Milius came in to my department and just started talking to us like we were somebody, and we were nobody, and directors don't talk to nobodies. And so he started telling us all these stories, and it was just a fascinating guy. Any topic, he was all into the swords that Kurosawa used in the movies and how they were made and how they were different from the real samurai swords. And then we finally got him to sort of hustle him into the screening room to show him some shots of his movie. He had gone next door. We had this little cafe called Foodles. And I really did not like the food there, and a lot of people didn't. And I was afraid that, you know, that this is not a good idea that he's going to eat at Foodles. But anyway, you got to take out. He's eating it. We're watching the thing. And pretty soon I hear, "This may be the best hamburger I ever ate in my life." And that was John Milius.
Well, there's something for everyone, I suppose, you know.
Well, he's a famous right-winger and an NRA advocate, and... he rubs Hollywood wrong at every cocktail party he attends.
Well, oh, you know, yeah. They can have my sword when they pry my whole dead fingers off it, right? Me and Conan.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he did the Clint Eastwood line, you know, about make my day.
Yeah. Oh, that was
yeah.
him.
Yeah, that was him.
Yeah.
Dirty
that
Harry.
Was Milius, yeah.
Awesome.
So he did the whole scene in Jaws, where the old sort of shark killer guy tells this story about their ship got sunk by the Japanese, and they're mm-hmm. all in the water, and the sharks start to circle and take them out one by one. That was all made up by Milius because Spielberg said, "I need something for this scene."
Perfect. Yeah, that's such a great scene in cinema history. You didn't have to, you know, do special effects. We didn't have to have a shark tank of circling sharks and Japanese, you know,
right.
soldiers. They
right.
saved them a lot of money that way.
Well, when we got to doing Jurassic Park, that was the huge breakthrough that changed movies forever.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
And it all came about because of a guy named Steve Spaz Williams. We all called him Spaz because, just like that giant kid in high school that everybody called Tiny,
uh-huh.
that's why we called him Spaz, because he was about as far away from a spaz
as Curly Joe.
And he's the only artist type that was also a mathematical wizard. He was the combination uh-huh. we never saw before. You know, remember that all the geek guys had pocket protectors and a bunch of ballpoint pens and mm-hmm. stuff? Well, Steve drove a Harley, wore a wife beater t-shirt, screwed around all day and worked all night. And they told him, do not work on digital dinosaurs. We're not doing it that way. It can't be done. It's experimental. And so I don't want to hear about it. And we're doing stop motion animation. It's all been worked out. Phil Tippett's going to do it. Dennis Muren is the head of this. Spielberger's already agreed. So Steve and a couple of buddies decide they're going to do it anyway. And
soft
homage. They get a wireframe. They get a wireframe of the creature walking. And he just puts it on his desk and in a loop running on his monitor.
Uh-huh.
And Kathy Kennedy comes through on a tour, and she says, "What's that?" And Steve says, "Oh, it's just something I'm working on." Mm. And she turns to Dennis and says, "What does this mean? I mean, could we do some shots like this or what?" Spielberg saw it, said, "I'll give you $50,000 to put skin on it." And then we sent it to him, and he said, "Everything's going to be CG. Mm. Stop motion.
Yep.
We would just take negative, and we developed a scanning machine, and we would, once you could get the negative into a computer as ones and zeros, then you could do anything you wanted with it and then film it out. So there was no digital way to send it out. So it was all put back onto film and projected film. And then when George insisted that everything was going to go digital, that editing was like scratching on rocks. That's what he told me.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I'm the chief rock scratcher here, and you're putting me out of work. So,
and yet you kept
so
work.
I made a documentary along with my friend Mike called Taming the Creatures about how this was done. And Spielberg did not want us to show it. He refused to let us show it at the film festivals because he wanted the magic. But I made it because I heard two grocery kids arguing over how it was done, and it was so funny how they thought we did it that I decided, okay, I'm going to record all of this, film interviews with everybody that worked on it, the actual artists, and intercut it with the film. And a friend of mine showed it to George, and when he saw the documentary, you know, nobody had ever seen this. I mean, like, from all these perspectives, how it was done. So he was kind of blown away by it. Called my boss, said, "I want to know how much it costs to make that, and I want to know this, and I want to know that."
Wow.
And he said, "Well, why didn't," he said, "I don't know why he didn't just call you." But anyway, he called me, and so, "Can you pull this together?" And I had trouble explaining why I did this to one of the big shot producers there. And but I got it done, and they paid for it. And they still show it at ILM, and I've got a copy of it that I just transferred to my Avid, and I'm going to YouTube won't let me run it because it has some of the music from the movie.
I'm gonna
drop those. Now you can go on my website and you can see part of it. There's some excerpts of it, and it's pretty interesting because Spaz tells the story and a lot of other people tell the story how this thing slowly developed into changing Hollywood forever. I mean, there's no other way to say it.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's the transformation of going from physical models, you know, the Phil Tippett approach to CGI, absolutely transformative, absolutely changed Hollywood forever.
And Hollywood wanted nothing to do with it. You know, I started to say
it was
that,
different. It was new. It was, nobody knew how it worked. No one, there were no experts.
Ray Harryhausen railed against it.
Well, Hollywood doesn't want to pay for anything. They don't want to do any R&D. They don't want to pay for anything. If somebody does it, they'll just buy it.
Right,
that's what
right.
happened with videotape. They tried to stop videotape. They sued and they sued and they sued, and it got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said It's the first sale doctrine. If you buy it, you can show it, you can sell it, you can do whatever you want with it. And it's wound up saving Hollywood's tail, because pretty soon the revenue from videotape, which they tried to stop, was the tail wagging the dog.
Yeah, because it far outstripped theater tickets.
So much money.
Oh, yeah.
And I was wondering why Spielberg decided to shoot instead of Panavision, why he was going to shoot in Super 35. Well, it was because of video, because they needed to get this stuff to video, because that was the moneymaker.
Yeah. Yeah, Super 35 is, I used to know what that meant.
It takes the area of where the soundtrack used to be.
Oh, yeah. Because need that anymore. You know,
so that's how Spielberg... See, we all thought there were two movies at ILM at the same time. One was Dragon Slayer, which we thought was going to be a monster because the work was just outstanding.
It was.
And so we got to all the employees, including the janitor and the janitor's son, were given the opportunity to see the movie at a theater in Marin, a really good theater, before it was released to the general public. You work for Lucasfilm, that was your treat. So we had a new receptionist. They showed one movie 1 week and then the other movie the other weekend. And I asked her, well, what did you think of the movies? And she was new and she didn't want to say, and she was very shy about it. But finally I got her to say, well, my husband and I, we liked E.T. And I thought, oh, my God. We thought E.T. was nothing because Spielberg wouldn't spend any money on it. He shot in Super 35 because it's too cheap to shoot it in Panavision. And it just blew the roof off, as we all know. Dragon Slayer did nothing. So I'm in the screening room one day, and somebody turns to George and says, what do you think about the fact that E.T. has just surpassed Star Wars as the most money-making film in history? And he said, good. Now maybe they'll leave me alone.
That's excellent.
I think it's because they raised the ticket price.
Where can people buy your book, Inside the Star Wars Empire, a memoir?
So you can buy it through Amazon. It's published by Roman and Littlefield / Lions Press. Mm-hmm. You used to be able to go into any bookstore, Barnes & Noble, everybody had it. Then, you know, when the whole thing with the COVID hit, it's available from the National Book Network, which is one of the biggest distributors in the country. And most people buy it on Amazon. And
I did.
I do signings and things. And you can also get the audio book of it, which is kind of interesting. I've been driving back and forth to Sacramento a lot lately from San Francisco, and I've been getting into audiobooks, and it makes the time pass.
Oh, audiobooks
so
are
great.
So
it's a good way to hear mine.
Yeah, the stories that you have to tell are just amazing. You seem to have been right there at the dawn of everything that makes modern cinema wonderful, and we are so privileged to have had the opportunity to speak with you, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I was so lucky to work on a bunch of films that actually, you know, turned out that they're still good.
Oh yeah,
they've held up.
Yes, they absolutely have. Ladies and gentlemen, and, we have been speaking to Bill Kimberlin, author of Inside the Star Wars Empire, a memoir. And I'm gobsmacked. This has been so much fun. And we so much appreciate your coming on the show to speak with us.
A lot of hardcore Star Wars fans, for them, it's not enough about Star Wars. You know, it was my life in motion pictures, and I happened to be there on Star Wars. And when George decided to restore Star Wars, I was on that project You asked before what other ones. I was there to do the restoration work with him. He called us all into a theater. He brought his personal 35mm print off the original negative, and we ran it, and he talked about the things he wanted to fix that the studio would not allow him to, would not give him the money to. And so, you know, like any artist, they go back and they're never quite finished. And so it upset a lot of hardcore fans. But, you know, I liken it to you have a Picasso and he comes over to your penthouse and it's a $50 million painting. And he looks at it and he says, you know, I always wanted to add a little green to that. Would you mind?
If Pablo Picasso came to my penthouse, you know, I'd let him.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to say to that? I mean, it's different if the studio wants to change it. But if the filmmaker himself says, you know, I wanted this to be this way, and they wouldn't let me do it, and he's still angry about it. They on Empire, Bank of America wouldn't extend money, and they told him sequels don't make money. Imagine that.
You're
explaining this to the guy who then makes what I consider the best of all of them is Empire.
Yeah,
a lot of people have like that. Jedi. Yeah,
I really like Empire. And when I used to run the reel, we used to make these effects reels. In other words, just the effects, and present them to the Academy. And when I used to run the reel for Empire with the walkers and all that, I don't care who they, Michael Jackson, whoever they were blown away by that reel. And I'm guessing it would still hold up today. It's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, it absolutely does. It absolutely does. Phil Tippett and his crew did a fantastic job on them. Yeah,
I mean, these are things that no one ever saw except us and Academy members. But I think ILM put them online. I'm not sure.
I think so. Yeah. Anyway, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a thrill. It really has.
Okay. And thanks for having me on your show.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye. You have been listening to episode 271 of Sci-Fi.Radio's production of The Event Horizon for April 13th, 2024. Our guest this evening has been Bill Kimberlin, and we have been speaking with him about his life working for George Lucas and Lucasfilm as a visual effects artist and editor. His book, Inside the Star Wars Empire, is available on Amazon. This show will air again tomorrow, April 14th, 2024, at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, and again on the following Thursday and Saturday mornings at 4 a.m. Pacific, 7 a.m. Eastern. After all of the air times have passed, you will find this episode and others on iTunes, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and on our own website at sci-fi.radio. If you enjoyed the programming you have just heard, please consider visiting patreon.com/sci-fi-radio and become a patron of the station. We are listener-supported sci-fi and fantasy fandom radio, and your contributions go to paying our DJs, our production team, the writers for our Geek News website, our business operation fees, our music licensing, and much more. We have been broadcasting continuously since 2009, and we are thankful for the support of listeners just like you. That URL, again, is patreon.com/sci-fi-radio. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio is copyright 2024 by Krypton Media Group Incorporated. The Event Horizon on sci-fi.radio. It's sci-fi for your Wi-Fi.